As an oceanographer and physicist, Helen Chersky can explain how the ocean works. It's what she does in her new book called The Blue Machine. She describes it as a giant dynamic engine that drives every part of life in the planet. But there's another part of the story she tells in the book, what she calls a complementary perspective to the science. It's the tradition and culture of the ocean. She made this discovery in an outrigger canoe. She took up canoeing as a sport, but she didn't expect it would give her a deeper connection to the ocean. It was a 56-mile journey from the Big Island of Hawaii to Maui that gave Chersky this revelation about how the ocean really works.
It was a special occasion for lots of reasons. There were a group of us that had done it, and we'd done the racing part, and then this was a different thing. And we could do it because there was a guy on Maui called Kimakeo Kapehulahua, who is very enthusiastic about sharing Hawaiian culture, and he's very enthusiastic about people experiencing the ocean. So an outrigger canoe is a six-man canoe, but it's got this extra hull out to one side. So the boat is very stable. On the water, it kind of rides the waves really well. And then every canoe had two crews, so we would swap throughout the day. So I was in one canoe and we would paddle for an hour, and then we would have an hour's rest and the other crew would paddle. So between the two crews, we would paddle this all the way across from the Big Island to Maui, which is a long way. So the sun rose and Kimakeo blew a conch shell, which was kind of the signal for everything to begin. And then we started paddling. And we paddled and paddled for an hour. And then we switched and I got my first rest. And then it was the second time in the canoe that really stuck with me forever. So as we were crossing the channel, the waves were coming from our right. And they were really beautiful waves. They were kind of 2 meters high and all perfectly lined up. And so for the first hour, we'd been going kind of across the waves, parallel with the crest, so it was kind of bumpy. But for the second hour, the canoe turned and we were paddling downwind. And the amazing thing about what we were doing was that it wasn't just the boat and the paddlers that were making us move, it was the boat and the paddlers and the ocean. And then if you just catch a wave right, you can kind of surf down the wave a little way. And then you paddle and paddle and paddle and paddle and paddle until the next wave catches you up. And then you surf down that one a little way. It feels like you're flying. My coaches had always talked about connection, you know, that the paddle is your connection with the water. And then suddenly in that situation, I understood what they meant. When we put our paddles in the water all at the same time, we were connecting the canoe to the ocean. And by pushing on it, we were kind of using the ocean to go somewhere. You know, the ocean does have a shape. And the most obvious part of that shape is the waves. You know, the wind pushes on the surface, it kind of gets a bit of a grip of the ripples and it pushes them up into big waves. That shape lets us do something very specific. In the case of a canoe, it lets you surf, it lets you kind of piggyback on that energy and it helps send you somewhere. It was the sort of thing you couldn't experience except by doing it. You have to put in the time in the canoe. You have to learn how to paddle like that. You have to listen to all these people. And then when it all lines up, you're put in this situation where you can become a part of nature. And that shape of the top of the ocean is the part of nature that you're connecting to, and you're connecting directly to the energy that's in the travelling shape of the surface. Directly experiencing that was a real privilege.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Helen Chersky is with us talking about the shape, the anatomy, the nature of the ocean. Her book is called The Blue Machine. Though we didn't begin our conversation with the machine, we started in space.
Even now, people think that going to the moon was about the moon. And it's self-evidently not true, right? Because the pictures that people took, you know, sometimes people have pictures of on their walls from the Apollo missions back in the late 60s and early 70s. And they're never just of the moon. They're always of the astronauts, or they're of planet Earth.
Right.
Those were the interesting things. And so it's very typical of modern humans, I think, that we had to be doing something else to see, and the most valuable thing came by accident. We totally hadn't realized that was where the actual value lay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was only the Apollo missions, when we were trying to get to the moon, that we got far enough from planet Earth to actually see it. And of course, that's when you get these two famous photos, Earthrise in 1968 and the Blue Marble, 1972. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's obvious the planet is blue.
Yeah.
And so, but you can only see it when you're really far enough away from it that you're confronted by it. You can't miss it. And then it's crazy because, you know, if you think about it, we've spent 50 years describing ourselves as people who live on a blue planet, and that we never look at the blue. Mm. It's kind of spectacular. It's not just blindness. It's kind of a spectacular omission. But at the point we're at now, it's too important to carry on with that. You know, we're at the point where we have to understand what we are and where we live. And the ocean is a huge part of it. And it's not just about the colour. It's not just like, oh, look, there's a blue thing. That hides all this other stuff. And it's time for us to start looking at all of that.
So you talked about how we talk about the things that are in the ocean, but we don't talk about the actual, you know, ocean itself. We talk about sea monsters and, of course, beautiful fish, but the ocean itself is something that we don't, you say, really talk about. And so why is that? Is it because it's so vast and can be terrifying or seems inaccessible? Like, why is that?
So I think there's a few different reasons. One of them is the great, I mean, it's a fundamental part of how the ocean works. But from a human perspective, the great tragedy of the ocean is that light doesn't travel very far through it.
Yeah.
And this was what stopped, you know, because at the same time people were thinking about outer space in the 60s, there was another bunch of people thinking about what they called inner space, the deep ocean. And they were, you know, trying to make their sort of adventures down there. And they never really landed with the public for the sole reason that you can't have a big vista. You know, that you can't take a photograph that you can put on your wall quite as easily as you can take a photograph of the moon. So the first thing is that, you know, light doesn't travel very far through the ocean, even on a good day, really. It's a couple of hundred meters. We are very visual creatures. If we can't see it, we don't think it exists. So that's the first reason. But partly I think it's that the ocean is, it's kind of so many things all at once. Like once you get beyond that, it does very big things and it does very small things and it does very fast things and it does very slow things. And there's all these different perspectives on it. And it's so big that it's kind of hard to hold them all in your head. So we know, like individually, we know that if we meet a human, we know that that human might be a teacher, perhaps, but they're also someone's sister and they might also appreciate art. And they are also, you know, a kind of bunch of meat hanging on the skeleton. And they are also a brilliant climber. And we kind of hold in our heads that an individual person can be all of these different types of things, all completely different categories all at the same time. And we're not used to thinking about the ocean like that. And I think some of it is like, you know, there's that ancient parable of the three blind men and the elephant, where three blind men somewhere they find an elephant, and one holds out his hand and touches the trunk and says, oh, an elephant is like a snake, and one touches the leg and says, oh, an elephant is like a tree. What the elephant thinks of this, no one has ever asked. But the point is that they come up with all these partial truths, and they are all true. It's just that they're not the whole picture. And so I think partly that's the reason. It's that the ocean is all these different things. But because we never really put the effort, we're not confronted with all these different things all at the same time. We don't kind of build up this picture of, oh, so that's what the ocean is. It's the bit that's kind of, it does all these things simultaneously. And then you get something closer to a complete truth. And so I think it's that we're just not exposed in our culture, partly because water just looks like water and more water and other water, right? It all looks the same to us. So we're not exposed to all those different perspectives at the same time, but they are absolutely there.
One of the things you write about in the book is how we sort of have come to finally, and it took us a long time to realize that, you know, the vastness of the ocean cannot continue to, you know, absorb human influence, and finally come around to the point where we are talking about our effect, human effect on the ocean. But you say the conversation faces this really massive obstacle because we can't really talk about this clearly unless we sort of know how it works, how the basic function of how the ocean works. And I guess that's what you're getting at with the book.
Yeah, that's right. So imagine you go to a doctor and the doctor tells you that some very long and incomprehensible word is wrong with you. And you listen to that and you kind of go, well, you know, what do I do with that piece of information? Does that just mean I can never eat broccoli ever again? Does it mean I'm going to die tomorrow? And effectively, that's what all the news stories are like. You know, we're starting to, for the first time, really, we're starting to hear news stories about the physical ocean, you know, its temperature, for example, and what currents are doing. And I think the reaction of people subconsciously is to go, oh, well, that sounds bad, but I have no idea what it means, right? I have no context for this whatsoever. And it's really hard to have a meaningful discussion about what it all means and how to make decisions about what to do about it unless you've got some picture of what you're dealing with. And for so long, the ocean was just this mythical place called away, right? You know, humans just thought you could put things in a way, this place called away, and they never came back, you know, and that's what the ocean's been for us. It's just sort of away over there, you know, it's not a thing. And so you don't have a relationship with it. Most people don't really have a relationship with it. They might have a relationship with their bit of coastline, but they don't really think about the whole ocean as being part of their lives. And so until you get to the point where you sort of you've got a feel for what's actually going on, conversations about how it's changing or how we should treat it in general, in any case, are really hard to have because you're just kind of trading thing. You're trading facts that nobody understands, and so yeah. So the book is an attempt to paint a lot of those those different perspectives and say, well, this is how to think about it. You know, try put all these different ideas in your head. And then maybe by the end of it, you'll have a bit of an idea about what the global ocean is and how it works. And then that allows you to think about your relationship with it and what we do about it and how we treat it. And, you know, all the rest of it follows afterwards. We're really past the point where we can treat the ocean as this convenient void. We have to acknowledge it's a real part of our world and it's one that we need to, you know, it's part of our identity.
Mm. Okay, so let's begin. And I like... I suppose there are any number of ways we could start here, but I think the thing for me that was really – that helped me sort of figure this out, how it works, was thinking of it as you do, describing it as a gigantic engine, this, you know, tightly woven system. And you have to, as you say, you know, like in politics, you follow the money. In this case, you follow the energy. Can you take us through this? The Earth – traps the sun's energy for a time. It diverts it. And you say the ocean is basically the engine for converting that sunlight into existence, I guess, life, right?
Movement. So the definition of an engine is it's something that converts heat energy into movement. Yeah. And that is exactly what the ocean does. And the thing about this engine analogy, I think, is that that's the bit that's missing in the perception, right? We still have this idea that the ocean is kind of a big empty pond with occasional fish in it. And the thing about a pond is that in our minds, it's not normally doing anything, you know, whereas the ocean is very definitely doing things. It's got anatomy, it's got internal anatomy. It's too big just to all mix up. So basically, different bits of it have different characteristics, mostly horizontal layers, but then there's some very interesting things that happen within those layers and in the places where water moves up and down. So this engine is turning. It never catches up with itself. The sun is feeding in energy from above. And then, you know, that's getting sort of redistributed. Some of it's through the weather. So if the ocean is warm, it might help drive wind. And then the wind will push on the ocean again and push waves. And so you've got energy kind of feeding round and round. But the point is the engine is moving things around. It's moving water around for a start. Mm-hmm. But that water is carrying heat, energy in the form of heat, and it's carrying nutrients and it's carrying life. And so the types of environments that you get in the ocean depend on how the engine's turning at that point. And one of the things that's quite notable, you see it on the news quite a bit. There'll be a story that'll say something like, oh, and today off this coastline, suddenly there were thousands of jellyfish. Mm. And the way it's presented is as though, you know, the cosmos rolled a dice that day and said, you know, today it's jellyfish, tomorrow it'll be clarinets, day after that might be something else. Right. You know, as though this sort of randomly, oh, look, they, you know, popped up, here's the jellyfish. And of course, that's not the case. Yeah. What's happened is that the engine has turned underneath and it's the part that's come to the surface has got the right conditions for jellyfish. And then you've got jellyfish. But what you're seeing is kind of a manifestation. It's a shadow of what's happening underneath. And so so the engine, you know, it does things on very big scales and it does shunt heat around the planet. So water is a spectacularly efficient way of storing heat energy because you have to put loads of energy in to heat water up by even a little bit. So warm water is kind of a battery for heat. So the ocean is this enormous reservoir of heat and it moves quite slowly, but it does move the heat around. But the other thing it does is it fuels the atmosphere. So the atmosphere, the ocean is heated from above by the sun. Mm. The atmosphere is heated from below by the land and the ocean. So then the ocean can feed some energy back into land and wind can travel much faster than water can travel. And so together, the atmosphere and the ocean are continually shunting energy from the equator towards the poles on either side. So you've got this enormous shunting of energy. You're also moving water and you're moving nutrients and you're moving all these things around, and those create the different habitats on the world and the different, you know, weathers and the different environments for life. And suddenly you see that living inside an engine is a really useful place to be, and then you've got the motivation to explore how it works.
You were talking earlier in the story about your voyage in the canoe, about how seawater has shape. I wonder, this was interesting though. I think this is really, I don't know, this kind of surprised me, and I guess it seems obvious, but there's this sense that the ocean is featureless, that, I mean, it has waves, of course, but there is a kind of height to the sea surface surprised me. Will you talk about this part?
So it's funny, isn't it? Because we talk about sea level,
yeah.
And there is a sea level, and so we sort of assume that what that means is that the sea is level.
Mm.
That's the impression. You know,
right.
We've got the idea that things fall towards the center of the Earth, and the Earth is more or less spherical, and so everything falls down. So the surface of your water is more or less a big sphere. And the thing is, it's not true. Obviously, water moves. Mm. Like, it's very fickle in that way. So the water is just moving wherever the gravity pulls it. And yes, the gravity mostly pulls it downwards towards the center of the Earth. But if you have an area where you've got particularly more dense or less dense rock underneath it, for example, either the water will be pulled towards that bit or it'll be pulled towards the thing next to it. So, for example, Antarctica, we know it's a continent, it's land, but it's got kilometres of ice on top of it. Mm. And all of that ice has mass. And so the water around Antarctica is kind of pulled towards Antarctica. It's not going up anymore because it's already been pulled there, right? But it's just kind of held there a little bit because of the gravitational pull of all the ice. So the sea level, the sort of resting sea level, is higher than you might think around Antarctica because the water's all been pulled towards the ice. And of course, as the ice melts, it might start to slosh back. And then just south of the pointy bit of India, there is a hole in the ocean where sea level is, I think, 70 meters lower than you might expect. And that hole is, you know, a couple of thousand kilometers across. And so you get these really big features in the surface of the ocean, which, you know, so it's not quite flat to start with. I mean, you'd never see any of this from the surface because they're usually kilometers wide. But then there's these other patterns that sit on top of that. So, for example, if you get a big rotating storm, we know that as a storm goes past, you tend to have low pressure in the middle. Mm. But if you think about the atmosphere as pushing down on the ocean everywhere, and then as the storm goes past, there's this bit in the middle that pushes down a bit less than everything around it. So water is kind of being pushed down at the sides and not being pushed down as much in the middle. So the ocean kind of bulges upwards by about 40 centimetres in a storm. And we can measure this from satellites. You can kind of average out over all the waves and you can measure this bulge. And the other thing that lets you do is you could, when a current flows in a particular direction, the Coriolis effect pushes it to one side slightly. You know, that's that thing where if you're on a roundabout, a carousel, and you kind of throw a ball across to your friend, it'll look like it's curving to the right in the Northern Hemisphere. So the water is kind of being pushed to the side, but then it obviously wants to fall back down the hill. So you get this sort of balance. You create a ridge in the ocean wherever there's a current. And by measuring those ridges, you can measure ocean currents. So we've got satellites that can do this. So actually, you know, the waves are important, but they're kind of like little tiny fluctuations that are sort of, you know, just on the surface. And they're kind of hiding these big patterns, which we could only measure once we got satellites, but they are definitely there. And the ocean surface is not flat. And it's one of the reasons that predicting sea level and sea level rise is not always straightforward. It's because you've got to consider, you know, how the currents are moving and, you know, where the mass on land is, and all this kind of stuff starts to matter.
Mm. So we talked about the top. I want to ask you about the bottom, and I want to read this part of the book, because you mentioned that you say this, you say possibly the greatest tragedy of studying the ocean is that, you know, the physics of seawater, it keeps us from these grand panoramic views, you say. And you say that would give, if we could have that view, I suppose, of the seafloor, that would give our imaginations a framework to anchor our understanding. Will you say a little bit more about that? What would change about our perspective of the way we live in this on this planet if we could have a grand panoramic view of the bottom of the sea?
Well, I think the first thing is we'd see it as a place, because at the moment it's just the other side of a boundary,
right?
And no one really goes there. But if you could look down into the ocean, I think there would be several things that people would see. The first thing is they would see the shape of the seafloor, and they would see that there are enormous mountain ranges and great plains and valleys and kind of these sort of weird shapes where rivers spill out and you get kind of a fan of sediment and seamounts that just kind of poke up out of the seafloor in the middle of the abyssal plains. And so we'd see that it was a place, and it had the, if we're used to the land having features, right? We're used to hills and valleys and rivers and all those things. Well, those are in the ocean too. It's just we can't see them from the surface. So the first thing is it would give you a picture of that and the scale of it. You know, the biggest waterfall in the world is under the ocean, 3.5 kilometers high, sort of tipping over a ledge between Greenland and Iceland. And you know, if we could sort of see the water better, we might be able to see and appreciate the features that were down there. But then we'd also see the things moving around. So, you know, things get carried by ocean currents. And so if a particular current has lots of nutrients, for example, and the temperature's right, then you get life in it. And we'd sort of see, in the same way we look up into the sky and we might see flocks of birds moving around or getting blown around, or we'd see things in the ocean moving about. We'd see things moving differently at different levels. We'd see there were different things in the deep to what there is up the top. So I think that just being able to see it, that's when it becomes real to us. And then we've got, then we can see the stage. And then you know that there's a play to watch, because you can see the stage. The stage is set. And now it's all about what happens in it.
Helen Chersky, she's a physicist and an oceanographer. Her new book is called The Blue Machine, How the Ocean Works. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Part of the book is about the kind of, as you describe it, this dramatic internal anatomy of the ocean, how temperature or salinity, you know, is part of this process. And it's built in these layers. And one of the things that sort of helped me understand how these layers work, at least in terms of like temperature, for example, is the story you tell about a Greenland shark, which leads, as you've said, a very very slow, very cold life. But talk a little bit about what a Greenland shark tells us about these layers.
Well, it's very odd, a Greenland shark. It is, I mean, one of the oddest things in the ocean. They're quite large sharks. They grow to sort of three, four, 5 meters long. They live in the cold and the deep, as you said. You know, they're Greenland sharks, so they're adapted to water that's very, very cold. Most of them are blind because they've got some kind of parasitic worm that kind of hangs out their eye, but it's dark, so that doesn't seem to bother them. Mm. And they swim extraordinarily slowly, like a few centimeters per second. And they've got this kind of loose, baggy skin. Like our picture of a shark is something like a reef shark. It's very sleek. It's kind of very streamlined. It's darting about, hunting things with big teeth. That's not what the Greenland shark is kind of drifting out of the gloom towards you. And we know what's in their stomachs, and it's definitely things that swim faster than a few centimetres per second. So the implication is that these things are the most terrifying kind of ambush predator. Oh, and they're longer lived than any other large creature we know of. So they're thought to live to 450 years old. They only reach sexual maturity at 150. And it's because it's cold. So the cold slows things down. They're not being pushed to hurry up. So they just live life really slowly. So that's a cold water creature.
Yeah.
But in 2013, I think, in the Gulf of Mexico, which is obviously not a cold water place, a bunch of scientists were studying the consequences of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. So they were doing biological surveys. So they were putting down hooks, baited hooks, and pulling things up to see if what was there before afterwards was the same as what's there before. They put these hooks down 3 kilometres, the Gulf of Mexico is quite deep, and they pulled on deck a juvenile Greenland shark. And they were a bit surprised, but not very surprised. So they were surprised enough to take a picture of it, and, a few blogs got written about it. I think they published a paper. But they weren't that surprised, because when you go deep, the ocean is layered, so the surface layer is nice and warm. And it's heated by the sun, right? That's all the energy. That's where all the energy is. So it's warm, and that means it's less dense, and that means it floats. So there's this kind of layer at the top of the ocean that we call the mixed layer. Depending on the conditions, it could be tens, maybe 100 metres deep after a big storm. And it's just kind of floating on top of everything else. But what's underneath it is quite different. So if you go down to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico where they found that shark, it was 4 degrees centigrade up there, but it was 30 at the surface. So, that when they pulled it up on deck, that shark was warmer in death than it had ever been in life. Mm. And so the deep ocean is cold, and it's got these layers in it. Every so often you see, some people are into making those posh cocktails where they've got different types of, different things floating on top of each other. And it doesn't mix up for a very, very, very long time. And the reason is that you need energy to mix things up. And so the thing about the ocean is you've got this nice warm layer on top. You've got other much thicker, deeper layers underneath. And they don't really mix up. They move sideways because they're at the right depth for their density. So they kind of find their level and then they slither along sideways. But they tend not to mix up or down because that takes energy. You need to add some energy for that to happen. So you've got these layers. Mm. And so the shark was just down at the bottom of one of these layers. But the whole, almost the whole ocean has layers. They work slightly differently in different places, but that's just the most basic form of ocean anatomy. When you look at the ocean, you really are only looking at the surface, and it's quite different to what's underneath.
Mm. I want to ask you about this story you tell of a loggerhead turtle. What it is a barnacle tells us about the anatomy of the ocean.
So most barnacles have a sessile life, which means that they park themselves on a rock and they basically cement themselves on, and that's where they stay for the rest of their life. So barnacles are not really going anywhere. But there is a species of barnacle that has adapted itself to live on sea turtles, because, a turtle shell's a bit like a rock, and it can sort of cement itself on and it can sit there. And these are the ultimate armchair voyagers, because, of course, they're just sitting there, waving their little feeding parts into the water. Mm. And as the turtle swims, they're getting lots of things washing over the top. So they're fat and happy. But these barnacles can live for a couple of years. And as they live, they grow. So the way a barnacle grows is, if you imagine a kind of cone that's sitting on a hard surface, if you move it up a little bit and then fill in the gap with more hard stuff, your cone gets bigger, even though it hasn't gone anywhere. So basically the top part of the barnacle, that was the baby barnacle. Right. And then as it grows upwards, it keeps adding more and more underneath. And so as you go down the barnacle, basically those are different stages of its life. So it's like tree rings. It's got information written in the barnacle growth rings. And so there are chemical signatures left in that can tell you about the temperature and salinity of the water, if you know how to interpret them. Mm. So basically these barnacles are carrying the turtle's life history with them, or at least the history of the water it's been in. It's a bit subtle to interpret it, but you can tell whether a turtle has been, in a nice warm bay, stuffing itself with food or mating or something, or whether it's been out swimming in the colder ocean where there's less life. So you can read that in the barnacle. So yeah, the barnacles are like these little history books that the turtle carries around with it.
It gets us to this great story that you tell, again, in this idea where you're describing the anatomy of the ocean. You described it as this critical day, September 2nd, 31 BC. Mark Antony and Cleopatra, they're on the sea. They're at war with Octavian. He's going to become the leader of Rome. And you tell the story about how Mark Antony's ships at this on this particular day would not move on the sea. And you sort of work through how it is water can stop a ship. Tell us this story and what this tells us about the anatomy of the ocean.
Well, this is one of the great mysteries of the classical world, really. So this is at the point where the Roman Republic is about to become the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And so it's a really big turning point in history, basically. And so, as you say, Mark Antony and Cleopatra are kind of on one side of this and Octavian was on the other. And they had set themselves up for battle. And the way this worked was that most battles then. So Mark Antony's ships were battering ram ships. So they were built, they were sturdy ships, and they had these enormous bronze kind of pointy bits that came off the front. And the way you used this ship was that you would kind of just sail it directly into another ship on the beam and just, you know, bump it basically with this large pointy bronze thing. So you use it like a battering ram. And so there was they were at the edge of the sea in the Mediterranean, and so close to Greece, and there was a kind of like a river outflow coming from behind Mark Antony. So he was kind of, his ships were kind of fanned out, coming out of this river, and they're all sat there ready to go. And Octavian's ships are in the deeper water, sort of surrounding him. And the rules of battle then were that I don't know how they decided, but, you know, the battle was supposed to start when the sun rose, first thing in the morning. Mm. So what everyone expected to happen was that Mark Antony's ships, they were sitting there, they were all lined up. As soon as the sun rose, they were going to man their oars and their sails, and they were going to ram into Octavian's ships, and that was going to be the battle. But the sun rose, and nobody moved, and nothing happened. And then around lunchtime, Mark Antony's ships, they started rowing, and then they sort of, as they got closer to Octavian's ships, they started using slingshots and things to throw, you know, weapons. So basically they were using every kind of weapon they had that wasn't these they weren't using the ships as battering rams. And it was said at the time that the something was holding the ships back. Something, you know, the gods or something was kind of interfering. And, you know, at the time, classical observers thought that it was remora, these fish that sort of sucker on. And people thought that, oh, well, maybe the ships were, had, you know, covered in remora that kind of suckered on and they were causing all this drag. And then more recently, and so no one has really solved this. And what happened was that because the ships, you know, they couldn't fight. So basically Octavian, you know, destroyed the lot of them. Mark Antony and Cleopatra escaped to Egypt. Octavian took the bronze battering rams and built them into this enormous monument on top of a hill to kind of, you know, wave two fingers at the rest of the world. But no one really solved the mystery of why it was that the ships just hadn't been able to fight. And then more recently, something has come along, which is it's very credible. 2,000 years on, you know, who knows? But this is the only thing anyone's ever come up with that could really explain it. And so that outflow that was behind Mark Antony's ships, that was fresh water. And fresh water is less dense than salt water, so it floats on top of it. So what you quite often get at an estuary like that is that you get a layer of fresh water that is floating on top of all the salt water underneath. And there is this phenomenon which had previously been observed by an Arctic explorer called Fridtjof Nansen, and it was called dead water. And the way it works is that you have these layers. If you have a ship that is exactly the right size and a layer that is exactly the right depth, and you try and move your ship through the water, what happens is that you don't just generate a wake on the surface. You know, we're used to the waves that come out from behind the ship. But what you do is you generate waves on the layer between the fresh water and the salty water below. So you have an internal wave inside the ocean. And in order to move your ship, if the layers and the ship size is exactly right, in order to move your ship, you've kind of got to drag this wave in the ocean with you. And it's enormously difficult. It takes a huge amount of energy. So basically, it's called dead water because ships ships just basically stop dead. They stop being able to move. And so recent work has shown that at the point where that estuary comes out, you quite often get these conditions. And one of the other things that is known about that day was that Mark Antony's ships were bigger than Octavian's. Mm. So it's possible that one set of ships was the right size for this dead water and the other one wasn't. So it could be that these the layers in the water, which are shallower than the big layers you get out in the open ocean, but it's the same idea, that could have turned the tide of history. And that is why Octavian became the first emperor of Rome. And this is happening all the time. The world that we live in, the way it works, it's kind of set up by the way the ocean engine turns. So if you ignore the ocean engine, you're basically ignoring the thing which has created the environment you live in.
Helen Chersky, her new book is The Blue Machine, How the Ocean Works. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. What color is the ocean? I mean, from space it looks blue, but is it blue?
Yeah, well, depends depends on what day you're asking.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that if you give a child a bunch of crayons and you ask them to draw a tap with some water coming out of it, they will all draw that water as blue, even though any of them that have ever seen that have probably been poisoned, right? You know, if blue water was coming out of your tap, you would not, out of your faucet, you would not be drinking it. But we all just accept, you know, if a child drew the water as any other colour, we would kind of, you know, go, oh, well, water's not that colour, it's blue. No one has ever seen it, any blue water. It is actually blue. If you go to the North Pole, for example, you stand on an ice floe and there's places where there is extremely pure ice that has melted and it's got no impurities and it's a nice big pond of it, then it really is the most spectacular deep royal blue. It's almost like the world is cheating. It does look like food dye, but that is the true colour of water when there's enough of it all together. That's the trick. You have to have enough of it to really see the colour. But then, of course, you know, when things grow in the ocean, things that grow tend to be, they have chlorophyll, so they're a bit greeny, so that can turn the ocean greeny. And then, you know, the colour of the sky can reflect off the ocean. So if you're looking down from above, the ocean can look grey because it's got clouds reflected off it. Or there might be sediment from a river and that makes it brown. The details depend on where you look. And actually, oceanographers use ocean colour, the details of it, to measure what's in the water. And you can use ocean colour from satellites to tell you quite subtle things about what's living in the ocean and what kind of chemistry there is just from the colour. So colour... The colour, when the ocean's not the really deep, rich blue, it's got information in it. The colour has information. So you can kind of see what's in, you know, because a lot of what's in the ocean is tiny, tiny, like far too small to see with the naked eye. But you can kind of see it's there because of the colour. So it's kind of like seeing into the ocean without a microscope.
In your section on the nature of the sea, you write about salt and... You know, how the concentration of salt makes this big difference to the, you know, the physical structure and the machinery of the ocean. I wanted you to talk a little bit about this because if for no other reason, I just wanted you to talk about this extraordinary story. We're going back to turtles again, but the leatherback turtle who weeps as it eats. It's such a great story. Talk about this, if you would.
So if you ask people what they know about the ocean, they know if you put your hand in the ocean or you sort of go anywhere near it, you probably know that it's got temperature, it's salty because you can taste it, and it's wet.
Right.
And the saltiness is the one we kind of dismiss. We go, oh, yes, the ocean's salty. The ocean is really salty. If you wanted to make a sort of household bath as salty as the ocean, you'd have to put a whole bucket of salt in it. It's a lot of salt. And so it makes the water... more dense. And so salty water is more dense than fresher water. So that's one of the things that helps set the layers in the layering of the ocean. But salt is also interesting because it makes a huge difference to life. You know, my mother, who was a keen gardener, when I was a kid and she wanted to get rid of slugs, she would put them in a bucket and sprinkle salt on them, which is a horrible thing to do to a slug. But basically what it does is, it's kind of what happens when you put salt on a zucchini. is it sort of the water comes out from the inside, right? Mm. And, you know, it shrivels up the slugs. It's not any good for them. And that's just because of the salt. It's because of the amount of salt in cells and the amount of salt outside cells and the way water moves in response to cells. But salt is kind of poisonous mm-hmm. in quantities that are too large. So the reason it does that to the slugs is that your cells need a very specific amount of salt. And it is more salt than fresh water, and it's less salt than the ocean. So what we as creatures are about a third as salty as the ocean. And so we have to maintain that balance, which is why we vomit if we drink salt water. It's because our body looks at all of that, what is now effectively poison, and, you know, wants to get rid of it. It's also true that if you don't eat salt at all, you will suffer. You know, you need salt. You need some salt, but you need the right amount of salt. So one of the things we never really talk about in the ocean is that all the life in the ocean is somehow dealing with this vast amount of salt. You know, so whales, for example, seems to come in their prey. So they don't drink very much, as far as we know. Whales don't drink because they just get the water from their prey, and they kind of drink through eating, if you like. But every creature has a different way of dealing with it. And there's a species of turtle that lives on jellyfish mostly. And jellyfish is kind of seawater masquerading as life, right? It's mostly salt water with enough kind of cells around it that it sort of looks a bit like life. And they're definitely alive. They're just very, you know, most of them is salt water. And so if you want to eat these things, I mean, it's quite good eating jellyfish in the sense that there's quite a lot of them about in the ocean. You know, there isn't much competition for them, but there isn't very much of a jellyfish that's alive. So you have to eat a lot of it to actually get any nutrition. But that means you're also ingesting vast amounts of salt. And so the way that the turtle deals with this is it's got most of its head is a kind of gland for extracting salt from its blood. And so it kind of pumps it out into this gland. And then what it does, it has to get rid of it. So it pumps it out of the tear ducts of the eyes of the turtle. So sometimes you see pictures of female turtles kind of hauling themselves up onto the beach to lay their eggs. And you'll see they've kind of got this kind of gloopy tear that's kind of covered in sand dripping from their eye. And that's the salt being got rid of. And it's really thick and viscous. And these turtles, that's how they get rid of their salt. They kind of cry it out. So when they're feeding, they're crying. They've evolved a whole part of their head just to get rid of salt. So everything in the ocean has evolved a different mechanism for dealing with this enormous amount of salt.
You mentioned how most of the book kind of deliberately sidesteps the damage that we're doing to the ocean, because you wanted to mostly focus on the positive. But you do mention the damage that humans are doing to the ocean toward the end of the book, as you kind of explore the future. As you say, not to shock people, but you want to give people a sense of what's really happening. One of the things you write about is kind of the fundamental problem that we've sort of created is we were talking about that balance of energy earlier. And it sounds like what's happening in part is we're throwing off the balance in that engine. Is that a way to describe it?
Yeah. You know, the ocean engine turns in a particular way now because of the amount of energy that gets to it, you know, because of the conditions, because of the shape of the continents, because of its history, because of where the ice is. You know, this is the way the ocean turns now. It could turn in other ways. But because it's so important for setting the context for the whole rest of the planet, everything we know is entirely dependent on it being set up this way. And so if you add a bunch of extra energy to the ocean, and it is so what climate change is, you know, the extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it does trap energy. So it slows down the rate at which energy leaves Earth. So the amount of energy is slowly going up. And so it's energy. That's the problem. And more than 90% of that energy is ending up in the ocean, which on one hand is a great thing because, you know, we heat up the ocean a little bit, it stores an enormous amount of energy. But on the other hand, even a little temperature change in the ocean can make quite a big difference. So that the biggest risk is that heat is changing the shape of the ocean engine a little bit. So it's making the top more buoyant, so it's less likely to mix with what's underneath, and it means you can't get the nutrients from underneath, you know, up to the surface where you need to have them for life. You affect the amount of oxygen that the ocean takes in. You know, the ocean is gradually losing oxygen, I think 2% since the 60s or something like that over the global ocean. And you also, you know, if you change the speed or the, you know, strength of currents, you affect where the life is, right? And if things, you know, if animals are entirely adapted to turning up at one particular type of year, and this is how the ocean conditions are, and then they turn up and it's not like that anymore, they've got a problem, because they depend on the ocean being predictable. They navigate through these structures in the ocean because they're predictable. And so the problem is, and we're like that as well. We use the features of the ocean because they're predictable. And then the problem is, if you sort of change the shape of the engine even a little bit, you start to change those things that everyone took for granted. And that's a problem. And so once you think of it of an engine as an engine, you sort of seal that much more clearly. And of course, you know, the biodiversity crisis in the ocean, you know, sort of overfishing and pollution and all those kind of things, that matters as well. But those conditions are generated by the engine. We have problems with overfishing, huge problems with overfishing. And that's a thing that humans just do. But then it's also already harder for those fish, because it's probably warm where it's not supposed to be. And, you know, their food might have moved, you know, they might have had to go somewhere else to get food. So it's adding to the stresses for life in the ocean, as well as all the things that humans are doing to life directly. But the important thing about all of this is that knowledge gives you agency. And that once we understand that the ocean is this critical part of our world, and we understand our relationship with it, and we start to feel like we have one, then you make decisions about how to treat it differently. And if you know a bit about how it works, you don't have to remember. It's not like there's some shopping list of, oh, here are the things I have to do today to make things better for the ocean. You just understand. And so the important thing about all of that, I think, is that, you know, it is not the case that it's all so bad we might as well give up. And it's really important that people understand that. There are plenty of things that we can make an enormous difference to. And if we just understand how the ocean works, we'll kind of make a lot of those decisions almost subconsciously. Because once you realize how important it is, it's very hard to turn away from it. Humans throughout history have sort of, oh, we'll just put some stuff in the ocean, we'll just do this, we'll just do that, as though it wasn't doing anything to start with. But once you start from the point where, okay, well, before we put anything here or do anything or change anything, let's find out what the ocean was doing to help us there already. And then let's consider whether we can either work with it, or whether we're just not going to, you know, put this thing in that's very disruptive, or maybe that it's justified because it's an extreme case. But you have to start from the question, what was the ocean already doing in that location? And kind of work upwards from that, rather than starting with, I want to put my thing here. I don't really care about the consequences till 20 years down the line. So I think that understanding what the ocean is and talking about it all by itself helps us treat it better. And there is agency in learning about it. It stops you feeling helpless.
It kind of gets you back to that image we talked about from space, that, you know, they gave us perspective, because you say perspective gives us a context for our value system, I guess.
Right. Exactly. And you do need a framework. You know, we need a framework. And it's a bit silly if at least some of that framework isn't the fact that we live on a planet. You know, I've written before about, I think each of us has three life support systems. We've got our own body, we've got planet Earth, and we've got the infrastructure of our civilization, which now is a life support system for us. And if we can't understand our own life support system, you know, even if you're the most self-interested person alive, you probably still want to be alive, which probably means you want your life support system to be functioning. So it has to become part of your framework. And then that opens the door to have the discussions about values with that framework in mind. And then we can really, you know, get things done.
Helen Chersky, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Helen Chersky, she's an oceanographer and physicist. Her new book is called The Blue Machine: How the Ocean Works. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. If you have comments or ideas, you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.